We're taking stock of Foxconn Technology Group and what the tech giant will do with its Mount Pleasant factory. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Foxconn is off in a new direction, announcing a partnership with electric car maker Fisker. Democratic Representative Gordon Hintz said Thursday at a WISP Politics event that this project is just the latest in a string of promises.
It's hard to take the company seriously at this point. Ventilators, coffee makers, you know, $100 million to the UW system, innovation centers, Generation 6, Generation 10.5, 8K ecosystem.
What questions do you have about Foxconn's next move in our state? Will Foxconn be a net positive or are you doubtful? 800-642-1234. Ricardo Torres is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ricardo, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, can you provide us with any details, any specifics on what is happening inside Foxconn's facility in Mount Pleasant?
So that's a very simple but kind of complicated question. And part of the reason is a lot of media haven't been able to get inside physically. And normally during pre-pandemic times, Foxconn is very good when it comes to putting on some sort of display or inviting the media in for whatever milestone or achievement that they have brought in. I was there when they put up the first panels, the first concrete, panels for its manufacturing facility. But since the pandemic, all of that has been shut down. So it's been kind of difficult to get inside to know what exactly is going on inside. So some things that we do know, for example, is that they have made masks. We know that because Governor Tony Evers thanked them publicly for at least 100,000 masks they made. That was kind of early on during the pandemic. They continue to build buildings. We saw them complete their giant dome building that's for high-tech data servers. And that's really about it. I've spoken to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He has told me that he got a tour and that he saw workers making circuit boards. Not sure what those circuit boards are for, who they're going to be for, what they're going to be put in. And so that's kind of where we are right now in terms of what we know 100% as to what is going on at its facility in Mount Pleasant.
Do we know how many are employed in Wisconsin for Foxconn?
So right now, we don't know 100% how many are employed. We know that at the end of 2019, they needed to have 520 people hired in order to receive the minimum number of tax credits from the state. The state has certain thresholds that Foxconn needs to meet in order to get tax incentives. And we found out during 2020 that they had only hired 281 full-time workers that were eligible to count towards that tax credit. So as of right now, I could say maybe a couple hundred. One of the things that is part of the deal is Foxconn has to get audited by a third party. And that audit last year showed that there was lots of hiring being done by Foxconn towards the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be more hiring going on that we just aren't fully aware of right now. But again, I know that Foxconn in the past has held job fairs. They've gone to schools. They've done in-person events. And with the pandemic, doing those types of things is really difficult.
Yeah. We're talking with Ricardo Torres, who is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's giving us an update on Foxconn and what its future may hold in Wisconsin. With your questions and insights, does your company have a partnership with Foxconn? What is your company's role in the project? Have you received updates about future plans with Foxconn? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ricardo, a lawsuit was just dismissed by the plaintiffs that had argued Foxconn failed to live up to its promise of creating this high-tech screen plant and that it cost local governments hundreds of millions of dollars. What have you gathered from this lawsuit by a real estate company?
So that lawsuit, from the beginning, I've always questioned what their standing was. For one, it listed Racine County and the Village of Mount Pleasant as both the plaintiff and the defendant. And I don't know how that works. I'm not a law expert, but I didn't even know that that was like a thing that could be done. And I wasn't sure who would be awarding damages in that case and who was paying who in that case. And it seemed like a bit of a Hail Mary type of lawsuit. And so this was just something filed by one resident, Caledonia resident. It wasn't filed. For example, we've had lawsuits filed by people who lived in Mount Pleasant that have been dismissed. And mm-hmm. this didn't even seem to rise to that level. So I was really confused when this lawsuit first appeared, and it didn't surprise me when it was dropped.
Is there collaboration that you know of going on at the local and regional government level with Foxconn? I mean, how do the players in Mount Pleasant and Racine County regard Foxconn? Do we know anything about their relationship?
So I do know that Foxconn has given tours to some of the local officials, to Racine County board members, to Village Mount Pleasant board members, and the relationship with the local officials has always been pretty cordial. Mm-hmm. Foxconn has always been up to date when it comes to, you know, what they plan on doing next in terms of building, in terms of storage. And the Village of Mount Pleasant seems to be satisfied with the amount of updates that they get from Foxconn. And so as of right now, I don't think that there's anything negative. But during a pandemic, it's difficult. I'm sure a lot of people would like to have more access. Mm-hmm. And particularly on the Racine County Board, where there might be more opposition. But it's difficult to have those meetings right now.
Yeah. Let's look at Foxconn and this partnership with the vehicle maker Fisker, the plan to produce more than 250,000 electric vehicles a year. What is the nature of this partnership?
So details on that are pretty limited. We do know that the two companies have signed a memorandum of understanding, and right now, or at least recently, they have been working out the details as to what that partnership, what that actually means. And we don't know, for example, if those cars are going to be made in Wisconsin. It's one thing an official at Fisker has said that it makes sense that Wisconsin be considered. As
calling it the obvious choice, yeah. To the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and so they could be made here, but there's still a chance that they could be made someplace else. This is a car company that I don't think is very well known, at least not in this part of the country. They've really just gone public recently, and so this could be maybe one of those things where Foxconn has gotten in quickly on the ground floor with something that could take off, or this could be a situation where this doesn't go anywhere.
We'll have
to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, another wait and see moment here. We have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's business reporter Ricardo Torres, who's explaining the latest developments with Foxconn, what the future might hold here in Wisconsin. Was your family's home bought out due to the Mount Pleasant campus construction? Where are you now? Have you attempted to get a job with Foxconn? What was that process like? Have you worked on the Mount Pleasant facility? What would you like to say about it? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Foxconn Technology Group and electric automaker Fisker, they announced last month they're partnering to build electric vehicles. As we've been talking about, details are scant. They didn't say when they will begin production or where these cars will be made. Meanwhile, Racine County in the village of Mount Pleasant has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on infrastructure upgrades in recent years to prepare for Foxconn's footprint. How do you want to see the Evers administration renegotiate a contract with Foxconn? Do you live in the area? Do you have environmental concerns? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Ricardo Torres, who's a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Chris now in Port Wing. Hi, Chris. What would you like to add?
Good morning. I just wanted to point out that WEDEC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, has been in charge of making these negotiations happen, and they've been very opaque. It's been a great failure right from the start when it was run by the governor's office, but when the new governor came in, the legislature took control of WEDEC, and the transparency got even more opaque. We don't know what's happening with our tax dollars. This is a huge failure. WEDEC has a history of corruption and failed projects. We need a good investigation of WEDEC so we know what's happening to tax dollars.
Chris, thank you. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, WEDC, under a new administration, Ricardo could have a completely new agenda about what this contract would look like. And as Chris said, it's not transparent.
Yeah, the WEDC has been pretty tight-lipped when it comes to their current negotiations with Foxconn. One thing we know through open records requests is that it seems like both sides feel like a new deal is coming soon. Foxconn would like some more flexibility with what they manufacture, saying that they don't dictate, you know, how the market turns, and to which the WEDC's response is that they would like some more details as to what is being made. And that's really been the crux of what is going on right now when it comes to the conversations with those two entities. And when I've tried speaking to the WEDC, they've said flat out that, you know, they don't comment publicly on these negotiations because they want businesses to feel confident that these discussions, these conversations are happening in private, stay private until there is some sort of deal to be announced. And I think the WEDC under a Governor Walker administration, I think, was a lot more willing to go along with what Foxconn says, and as opposed to Governor Evers' administration, which is taking a lot more stricter by the rule, by the contract approach, which has kind of pitted Republicans and Democrats against each other when it comes to this project. One thing that I've learned in talking to state officials is that both sides agree that there won't be a need to pass more legislation like the one that was passed to lure Foxconn to Wisconsin. Mm. But that's about it. Republicans feel that Tony Evers and his administration, the WEDC, aren't following the law. Democrats feel like Foxconn needs to be more transparent in order to get these tax credits. And until the deal is lined up with what they're doing, that they shouldn't get tax credits. And so that's kind of how this breaks down politically in Madison.
We're talking with Ricardo Torres, who's a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's giving us a look at Foxconn and what its future might hold in Wisconsin. What questions do you have about its footprint, its presence, and what the future could hold? How are you affiliated with Foxconn? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ricardo, let's talk real estate for a moment. Foxconn had bought a downtown building in Milwaukee in 2019 to create the company's North American headquarters. It still owns the building, leases out space, but has anything happened with this property?
Not much has happened with this property. We know that they've leased out space to Exonia Bank, but right now some of the other properties around the state aren't really getting a whole lot of attention by Foxconn, and that's pretty deliberate. Foxconn owns a couple buildings in downtown Racine, And I've spoken to the mayor of Racine, Corey Mason. Last summer, he told me that Foxconn told them that they're going to be focusing more on their campus in Mount Pleasant. And to him, that seemed like a satisfactory response, that they would focus all their energy on Mount Pleasant. And then once that campus and those facilities get running, then they would start focusing more on some of their other properties around the state. But as far as what we know about their building in Milwaukee, we don't know much about what exactly is going on there. A lot like we don't know much about what's going on in Mount Pleasant.
In terms of these innovation centers, whether it's Racine or Green Bay, Eau Claire, Madison, is it the same approach there that they're not focusing on the innovation centers to put their attention to the Mount Pleasant facility?
That's correct, yeah. And that's the approach that they have decided to go with. And, so once Mount Pleasant, once things get settled down there, and once we have more of a clear understanding as to what's going on there, then I think we'll start to see more activity at some of these innovation centers.
Let's take a look at a couple more business opportunities that Foxconn had pursued. It had announced a partnership with Brigo Coffee to create these robotic coffee kiosks. What has happened with that?
So that deal completely fell apart. It was the first deal that was announced publicly late 2019, I believe. And this was something that people were kind of intrigued about, huh? We associate Foxconn with smartphones, tablets, things like that. And here they are going to build these robotic coffee kiosks that are in some airports. Okay, that's interesting. And then nothing happened for a while. And it turns out Brigo and its parent company were bought by the Coca-Cola company in 2020, early 2020. And by the time that Coca-Cola bought them, the deal had completely fallen apart. They did not make any coffee kiosks here. And both sides haven't wanted to comment on why the deal fell apart. And so we just know that it didn't happen, that it was announced, that everyone was excited, and then it didn't happen.
Another venture was ventilators. Early on in the pandemic, this partnership with Medtronic, what ultimately happened there?
So it was a similar type of thing. Early on in the pandemic, a lot of us can remember that ventilators were on very high demand, that there was a lot of call for more ventilators, that we didn't have enough ventilators. And so Foxconn and Medtronic entered into this deal to make more ventilators. Medtronic had a design that they made public, and Foxconn agreed to mass produce those ventilators. But then as things changed with the pandemic and as the demand for ventilators changed, Medtronic said there wasn't as much of a need for these ventilators. And so, again, that deal dissolved. It's unclear if they made any ventilators, or if they did, how many were made. That hasn't been commented on publicly. But it also seems, unlike the Brigo deal, it also seems that both sides are still willing to move forward with some sort of partnership. You know, I don't know what that means in terms of, actual products, but it just seemed to be a shift in the market, which is what Foxconn points to, is their need for flexibility with the WEDC. That market conditions change, that supply and demand change, and so they need to have the flexibility to meet those changes. And so that's one of the reasons why they're pushing so hard for that flexibility in this new deal with the WEDC.
And, I'm wondering, too, deals come and go. I mean, is this something that we should just, this volatility, if you will, is something we should maybe expect from a contract manufacturer that has to go out and find business?
I think so. I think with a lot of businesses, if you talk to business owners, they'll tell you about deals that they had in place at one point or another, and for whatever reason, those deals didn't work out. But I think one of the differences with Foxconn is that there has been so much taxpayer money poured into the infrastructure, bringing Foxconn to Wisconsin and making the area in Mount Pleasant habitable for them when it comes to water and other services, and that the incentive package that was originally passed to lure them here. And so that's a little bit different when it comes to just how business is done. And so, yeah, you kind of have to take both into account that businesses come, deals come and go. That's part of business, but not many businesses have gotten the support, the taxpayer support, as Foxconn has.
Ricardo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ricardo Torres is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Even in the hyper-partisan atmosphere of Washington, D.C., Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson keeps turning heads lately. Johnson has said a lot, from questioning the results of the election to downplaying the insurrection of the U.S. Capitol. The comments strike many political observers as a clear sign that Johnson will seek a third term in the Senate at a time when the Republican Party's base still supports Donald Trump. Sean Johnson reports.
A recent Senate hearing on the insurrection started out harmoniously. Senators from both parties had just weathered the siege together a few weeks earlier. They pledged to work together to find out what happened. There were pointed questions from Democrats like Minnesota's Amy Klobuchar.
Would you agree that this attack involved white supremacists and extremist groups?
Yes.
Okay.
And Republicans like Ohio's Rob Portman.
Why wouldn't we be prepared for an infiltration of the Capitol?
And testimony from law enforcement leaders who were at the Capitol on January 6th, like former U.S. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund.
I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war.
But the tone changed when it was Ron Johnson's turn. Instead of asking questions, he spent most of his time reading someone else's account of what happened that day from the conservative website, The Federalist. It described the mood of the crowd that attended Trump's Stop the Steal rally on January 6th as positive and festive.
Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone.
The article referenced four groups of people who stood out: militants, provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and disciplined attackers. As Johnson read from the piece, he paused to offer his take.
I think these are the people that probably planned this.
The comments rubbed many in the room the wrong way. After all, on January 6th, they were whisked away with Johnson to secure locations when rioters overtook the Capitol, including the Senate chamber. It wasn't the first time Johnson had hinted at these ideas. Weeks earlier, Johnson went on conservative talk radio to question whether the insurrection was actually armed. Larry Sabato directs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says people are surprised that Johnson is minimizing what happened.
It was an historic event, and it's going to be remembered a lot longer than Senator Johnson is.
A.B. Stoddard is an associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics. She says she knows Johnson, and she thinks he knows what he's saying isn't real. Her theory is that he's saying it anyway to try to win over Trump's GOP base.
You know, he's basically going where the wind is blowing. You know, his voters are asking for this, and he wants that job.
Johnson's office didn't respond to a request for an interview. He hasn't said yet whether he'll seek a third term. In 2016, Johnson promised he would not run again.
This will be my last term. I'll never vote my reelection mind because I'll never stand for reelection again.
Johnson has since walked back that pledge. Stoddard and Sabato say Johnson has changed since he was first elected. Back then, he ran as a political outsider and businessman who was fixated on reducing the debt. But Christian Schneider, a conservative writer and columnist who had behind-the-scenes access to Johnson's first campaign, sees a common thread. In 2010, Johnson's staff went to great lengths to get him to be more cautious at a time when he would frequently go off message. It never quite worked, but Johnson won anyway.
If there's any lesson that he's probably learned, it's to trust his gut. And his gut right now is telling him to kind of be the most pro-Trump senator imaginable.
This week, Johnson has moved on to a new issue, attacking President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 bill. But he didn't just debate the bill. Johnson forced Senate clerks to read the entire thing aloud, hour after hour, to a nearly empty Senate chamber.
402A2 of Division N of the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, Public Law 116-260.
Democrats said the move would only delay $1,400 checks and extended jobless benefits to Americans who need them. While the parliamentary tactic is exceedingly rare in the Senate, it seemed like familiar territory for Johnson, who these days jumps quickly from one controversy to the next. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, instances of police brutality and holding officers accountable for misconduct is an urgent issue for our nation. 538 reported it's rare for police officers to face criminal prosecution. The resulting settlements can be expensive for cities and ultimately subsidized by taxpayer dollars. Have there been police misconduct settlements paid out where you live? For how much? Have you considered filing a lawsuit against law enforcement? Join in 800-642-1234. Laura Bronner is quantitative editor of 538.com, part of the ABC News Network. 538 worked with the Marshall Project on a report showing that cities across the country spent more than $3 billion on police misconduct lawsuits over the last decade. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you looked at police misconduct cases over a decade in 31 cities, big cities like New York and L.A., and much smaller cities like Roanoke, Virginia, population barely 100,000. What did you find?
Well, there were three main takeaways from our investigation. One, as you said, cities are spending a lot of money on police misconduct settlements. Over the past 10 years, it was over $3 billion just in these 31 cities. And those are obviously just a subset of the cities in the country. Secondly, this is sort of the main thing that our article tries to go into, is they're not really tracking data on how much they're spending in a way that lets us understand anything about which cities are doing better than others in terms of dealing with police misconduct, which are getting better or worse, what might be causing any kind of improvement. The lack of data quality, the lack of what's being tracked was really shocking to us. And third, all the data we received is public. We made it public on GitHub so others can build on what we did.
So looking more closely then on that last point you said on the data, you have been lamenting that, you know, you had bad data, incomplete data, that there wasn't uniformity in how cities are reporting police misconduct. So what is at the heart of this problem?
Well, let me start by explaining why this matters. If you want to know whether things are improving in a city, whether misconduct is changing, whether more people are suing, you have to know the settlement amounts. But that's not enough. You also really need to know what the misconduct was that resulted in these settlements. And that's exactly why it was so frustrating that the data we received when we received it was so bad. One thing we realized was that it was quite possible that we're just missing data, even from these 31 cities where we got something. It's not clear that we got everything. Multiple cities told us they weren't keeping records in a form that would allow them or anyone else to easily analyze how much money they were paying. Some places gave us some court documents and told us to figure out totals on our own. Others sent data that was easier to analyze, but told us that it would probably didn't cover everything. Cities gave us very different things in response to our FOIA requests. And though we tried to standardize it as best we could by removing things that we didn't consider the same type of misconduct, we weren't always able to. Sometimes because we didn't get any definitions at all of what the misconduct was that led to a settlement.
So what counts as police misconduct? How did you set this up?
So in our data cleaning, which was a big component of the process, we tried to limit it to examples of police abuse or misconduct towards civilians, things like constitutional claims, wrongful or false arrest, excessive force, brutality, shooting, wrongful death, sexual harassment, those kinds of things. Things we generally tried to filter out were car accidents, slip and falls, employment lawsuits, and anything city-related that wasn't police-related. So in some cities, they gave us data on traffic light problems or sewage overflows or stuff like that that wasn't actually related to the police, just because of who covers the area that covers those kinds of settlements is often the same. But sometimes it wasn't possible to do that kind of filtering. Some cities didn't provide any description at all of the misconduct that had led to the settlements, like I said. And that meant we couldn't filter anything out. And other places provided extremely vague categories, which made it hard to distinguish between, say, a fender bender and a police chase that injured a suspect, which are sort of both car accidents, but very different kinds. Personal injury, for example, is a category that can include accidents, but it can also include the kind of abuse that we would be trying to capture.
Yeah, you would obviously need a little bit more information on a lawsuit by lawsuit, case by case basis. Were you able to see any trends in cities, or were the payouts up and down each year?
So in the data we have, more money comes from the later years than the earlier years.
Okay.
We were looking at the 2010 to 2019 period. But that's also because some cities only gave us data for the later years, such as Atlanta, Baltimore, and St. Louis. And even if there was actually an increase over time, it's kind of unclear what that means. We don't know if that means that policing problems have gotten worse, or whether that's evidence that more victims are coming forward, or whether the city is just starting to take it more seriously and compensate people more generously for the harms that they've experienced. There's so many factors that go into whether misconduct results in a settlement, whether the victim chooses to file a lawsuit in the first place, how much protection police officers have legally in each state, whether civil rights attorneys are willing and enthusiastic about taking on these cases, whether it gets media attention, whether a jury might be more disposed towards awarding a settlement, which can then pressure a city to settle. To awarding a judgment, which makes cities more likely to settle, that it's very hard to tell whether an increase in money being awarded is like a bad thing because it implies more misconduct, or whether it might actually be a beneficial development because it implies that more victims are getting at least some form of compensation.
You know,
I
just wanted to say that, you know, here we are at the start of the Derek Chauvin trial, the former officer who pressed his knee on George Floyd's neck as he gasped for air. What set you on this journey to gather this data?
Well, that's exactly one of the starting points, is we realized when Derek Chauvin was charged just how rare it is for officers to be criminally prosecuted. And when we looked into what generally happened after these high-profile instances of police misconduct, police abuse, civil lawsuits are a much more attainable form of justice and compensation for people that are the victims. So if victims get any kind of compensation at all, it's often in the form of monetary settlements rather than criminal charges for the officer involved. So that's when we decided to take a deeper dive into just how much cities had been paying out, and to try and see whether there are any changes as a result of the increased attention that police misconduct and violence have received over the years.
We're with 538.com data scientist Laura Bronner sharing statistical analysis on the price of police misconduct lawsuits for cities. Settlements may cost millions of dollars. Do you think there should be a cap on payouts? Should these payouts related to police misconduct lead to mandatory changes and police reforms in the department? Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Laura Bronner here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with 538 quantitative editor Laura Bronner. Cities across the country, big and small, spend millions of dollars each year settling police misconduct lawsuits. And these settlements, they add up, ranging from multi-million dollar payouts to far, far less. 538 and the Marshall Project, they dug into the data to look more closely at the financial implications for cities. And Laura Bronner is with us for 10 more minutes. Laura, your data included the city of Milwaukee. What can you tell us about the Milwaukee payouts in particular?
That's right. So in Milwaukee, we have 56 entries, $40 million in total over the 10 years. But there's a wide range there. They range from around $1,000 to $7.5 million. The biggest payouts were for wrongful conviction cases, which you might be able to remember. Robert Lee Stinson was $7.5 million after spending 23 years in prison. And there were others like that. But there were also multiple cases of body cavity searches, excessive force, stop and frisks, and wrongful death that led to these payouts.
And so you can't assume there in Milwaukee as well that you could compare it to the other cities as you looked at, you know, the range of these payouts and what it actually means for a city.
You might assume that, but it's not as easy as you might think. The categories that we received, the descriptions of what these settlements were for, differed enormously across the different cities. And that's when we received any descriptions at all. So even categories that came up in multiple cities, like civil rights, for example, were really hard to compare. Mm. In Cincinnati, for example, civil rights cases, or those that were labeled civil rights, made up 37% of the total. And in Charleston, South Carolina, they were only 10%. Mm. But we can't assume that Cincinnati's police officers were more likely to commit civil rights offenses. In Cincinnati, the data was broken out into just six buckets. In Charleston, there were much more buckets, several of which could also be reasonably classified as being related to civil rights, like search and seizure or false arrest. Whereas in Cincinnati, there were fewer categories and some were sort of catch-all, like litigation. So it's totally possible that if you took the same incident, it could be categorized as a civil rights violation in Cincinnati, but as a false arrest in Charleston. And we just don't know about that. We just don't know if that's happening because neither city gave us any definitions for their categories.
Yeah, litigation would be a very big umbrella, very broad category.
Right. Exactly.
Let's take a call now. Patty is joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I just wanted to put in some more information about data that might be missing. So I'm a truck driver, and I was pulled out of my truck and assaulted out in Jessup, Maryland. When I went to court, it was kind of just a hurry up and pushed off thing. And the only thing that I had asked for was the police officer to receive some kind of psychological help for his actions. So I never received a settlement or anything like that, and I never did find out if the police officer ever did get any kind of help. I wasn't allowed to have that information, but that's some more data for, I mean, the case is there. It shows what the judge apologized for having me come back out, but it would have been more of a financial hardship on me to run back and forth. And I was on crutches. I had to go through rehabilitation. But I was just pulled out of my truck and assaulted. And he never even identified himself.
Well, Patty, thank you for sharing your story. And very much one, Laura, of being inconclusive. And, you know, Patty wanting something out of the case and really not knowing whatever happened.
That's exactly right. I think that's a really great example, Patty's story, of just how the data is incomplete, because as she said, her case wouldn't be included in the data we have. And yet it's a really important case. That's a problem that we have when we ask for the specific kinds of data, in this case settlements, because it will exclude things like non-financial outcomes that are still a really important indicator of what's actually going on between the police and civilians.
We're talking with Laura Bronner, who is a quantitative editor of 538.com. 538 teamed up with the Marshall Project on a report showing that cities around the country spent more than $3 billion on police misconduct lawsuits over a 10-year period. Laura, let's look more closely at insurance and insurance payouts. Insurance companies for cities may decide to settle cases and pay plaintiffs. How did you look at this in your analysis?
Well, insurance is kind of a difficult thing to look at, in part because it differs. Again, this is sort of the refrain of this piece, is that everything just differs so much between cities. In some places, insurance is what covers these settlements. Of course, that still means the premiums are still covered by the city, and they rise when there are payouts. So ultimately, it is still paid for by the city and by the taxpayers. But sometimes the insurance is an in-between, a mediator in that process. And that can affect, again, the kind of data that we have. Sometimes the data comes from the insurer rather than from the city itself.
Do you know how these large payouts affect a city at all? Like, you know, in terms of getting this money, paying it out?
Well, we know that sometimes when there are large payouts, that can be a prompt for or that can be a cause for cities to actually try and increase some of the transparency around these processes. So Chicago, for example, recently began publishing reports on litigation involving the police department, including how many lawsuits were filed and paid out. That was actually required as part of a court-supervised consent decree with the state. But that gives us some more information on these instances than many of the cities we looked at.
Do you see a movement in that direction at all, that Chicago, like Chicago, having to improve how they collect this data?
That is a movement that we have seen in some of these, especially the bigger cities, Chicago, New York. It's sort of an ironic thing that in some of these cases, in some of these cities that have a lot of these payouts or very high profile ones, more transparency is sometimes one of the things that comes out of that as cities promise to do better, to collect more data on this. Of course, it's still not necessarily comparable across cities. What we got from New York and Chicago, both cases were quite detailed, but it was different information that we got. But it can sort of lead to the paradoxical conclusion that some cities have more going on in terms of police misconduct, but actually all we're seeing there is increased transparency rather than actually more misconduct by police necessarily.
Has your team discussed following up on this report, trying this over again, looking at a new data set?
Well, we have. This was a long process. I think one of the things we would be very interested in is trying to look at complaints, which are sort of the other side of this coin. As Patty's call demonstrated, there are complaints for things which don't result in a settlement. But that, again, is very different by city. And it's in some cases even harder to get because there's not the same accountability claim that you can make on a settlement.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Bronner is quantitative editor of 538.com. You can find a link to the report at wpr.org/mornings. Stay with us. We check in with administrators from technical colleges around the state to see how they're handling the stresses and problems related to the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.